Good morning to everyone. I wonder if you'd be kind enough to just sort of sit with me for just maybe 2 minutes or something, just to let us let go of this earlier this morning and let go of later this afternoon, and just sort of be present and give our hearts and minds a chance to unwind just a little. All right, thank you. That's a little better, isn't it? Well, this morning I'm going to talk to you about... can you hear me okay back there? All right. This morning I'm going to talk to you a little bit about sewing practice, Zen sewing practice. And I'm talking about this morning because it's on my mind and it's in my life again. Zen sewing has reemerged in my life, which it has a tendency to do. And for those of you who are newer to Zen Center, one of our senior teachers here, Rosemary Taylor, is a Zen sewing instructor. And she's our senior sewing teacher here. So if you're doing any kind of Zen sewing, she's your resource. And she has given a number of talks over the years about sewing practice. Zen sewing practice. So if this is interesting to you, I would encourage you to look through the talk archives on the website. We have on our website, I'm sure most of you know this, we have like the five most recent Dharma talks, I think, the five most recent Sunday talks. And if you're a member, you get access to the archives, which are hundreds more of older talks. So if you're a member and you're interested in this topic, please go back and check some of those old talks out by Rosemary. They're wonderful. If you're not a member, then just become a member, and then you can get the password and go. See how I folded that in? And I'm starting by saying that just because every single thing I learned about sewing in Zen, I learned from Rosemary Taylor or from Tomoe Katagiri. Those are the people that I have spent all of my time sewing from. So I want to give them credit for anything I'm about to inadvertently steal, and the potential for misquoting them is always high, and that's dangerous. So I want to give them credit for their compassionate help and for their wonderful practice. So, sewing in Zen, sewing in Buddhism, according to the story, goes all the way back to the historical Buddha. So 2,500 odd years. The historical Buddha wanted a way of, so the story goes, wanted a way of setting his sangha, his disciples, his students apart from the followers of any other given sect or religious order at that time. So what they did is they gathered discarded cloth, bits of discarded cloth from the funeral pyres, from trash heaps, from wherever, just bits of discarded cloth that had no value to anyone else, and they cut those up, they dyed them to a semi-uniform color, and then they sewed them back together again in a specific pattern, again as part of their kind of identity as Buddha Sangha. And so the pattern that they used, according again to the story, is that of a rice field. So in ancient India, perhaps in contemporary India, rice is the staple crop. So the paths that rice farmers, planters, and harvesters would make through the rice fields were long series of paths that were long and then short, going crosswise. So I'm showing you my rakusu here, which is sewn in the same pattern, and a lot of folks around here wear these rakusus if they've been through initiation or ordination or something, and they all follow this same pattern. They would have worn larger, full-body robes we would call okesa, but again, same pattern and same symbol, the symbol of the rice field. So when we do sewing in our tradition, in Soto Zen, Buddhism, we sew one of these very small versions of the robe, again called rakusu, that's the Japanese word. It's worn around the neck like this. And we sew one of these if we are being initiated as formal Zen students, I guess you'd say. And some folks go on to sew others if they choose to be ordained or get transmission or something. But we all follow the same pattern. And the sewing is done by hand, of course. And we would only have to say that now, because, of course, back then there wouldn't have been another option. Sewing is by hand. How else would you do it? Well, now we have magic machines that go, and you could sew one of these in probably half an hour if you had one of those. But no, we do it by hand. And we follow a very specific pattern. There's a very specific stitch. And we do it in silence, largely, which is probably not a surprise to anybody here. It's a meditation. It's a meditation, right? Like everything here is a meditation. And as we pull our thread through, we repeat to ourselves, I take refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha. Namo Kiya Butsu. I take refuge in the Buddha. So the robe practice, the practice of sewing, becomes an active meditation, right? And during the course of the 3 months that it takes most people to do one of these, you've taken refuge thousands of times, right? With every one of these little rice grains, that's refuge. So it's actually a beautiful tradition, and we still follow that. And so as I was thinking about this, and as I've learned from Rosemary and from Tomoe-san, like everything in Zen, you know, there's a little bit of a, there's always a sense that there's a little bit of a hologram type of deal going on at Zen Center. Like any one given thing, if you go far enough into it, you find everything else. So does that make sense? Like cooking practice turns out to be, oh, I get it, everything is here. Sewing practice, oh, I get it, everything. Sweeping practice, oh, I get it. Zazen, right? Everything kind of contains everything else. But it's a neat metaphor for Buddhist practice, and it's a neat metaphor for our Zen lives, is sewing. So we do not gather discarded rags from funeral pyres. We don't have funeral pyres. What we do is we go to Joann Fabrics, and we buy the cheapest cotton cloth we can buy. The idea, the spirit behind that was to try to choose something that would arouse no desire. No arouse, no desire that nobody else wants. It has no value, right? So the robes are traditionally colored in a very plain sort of way, so as not to go, ooh, right? The way we normally, you know. I usually want to get dressed in the morning and put on something that makes me look fabulous, and this is sort of the opposite of that. Just something that's very, very plain, that doesn't arouse greed in the mind of others. That's seen as compassion. To choose to wear something that doesn't arouse greed in your mind is a gift, the way this is framed, right? So we go to Joann Fabrics because if you buy, you know, country cotton for $5.99 a yard, it's pretty hard to get too greedy about that. It's pretty plain stuff. And we're given a large piece. We cut it up into lots of little small pieces, and then we sew them back together again. That's a great metaphor for Zen practice, actually. We take one big undivided thing, we cut it up into pieces, and we sew it back together again. And it actually is just like our life. Whether you've ever done sewing practice or not, it's entirely beside the point. But we are all born with that one big undivided awareness. You know, we're born with it. Most of us don't remember, but when we're born and we see, we don't know we're seeing. We don't know that's a face. We don't know that's the wall of a hospital. We don't know that's mom or dad. Undivided. We don't know self. We don't know other. It's just undivided consciousness, a big piece of cloth. And we learn very early. I'm told the very first dualism we learn is self and other. Self and other. You know, when you kind of like bite your hand in the crib versus biting the blanket, at some point it dawns on you, there's a something here. You know, the first time mom leaves the room and you realize, oh my God, maybe that's not me. It's terrifying. But it happens, so self versus other. We start learning about good versus bad. We start learning about time, life, death, all the dualisms, right? All the splits. We have one big undivided piece of cloth, and we cut. It's wonderful, right? It's what our consciousness does. It's what we need to do. We need self versus other. We need good versus bad. We need those, right? They serve us at a certain level. They do. When I leave here today, it's important for me to know which one of those bikes out there on the rack is mine, and that I go home to my house and not your house, right? I can see those things as ultimately illusory, but it's kind of helpful. So that's what we do. We cut them up into little tiny pieces. We cut up big mind. And with Zen practice, for those of us who come to this practice, that spirit is that we are now sewing all this back together again. We are reminding ourselves of undividedness. We are reminding ourselves that our function of splitting things up is essentially a survival function. Again, super helpful. Very powerful tool, but it doesn't necessarily reflect reality accurately. So we spend all this time sewing the pieces back together again. Tim sometimes calls this calling in the shards during our Zazen practice. Calling in the shards, bringing these broken pieces of ourselves back together again. And when you do Zen sewing practice, you learn that the way you treat your cloth, your needles, your thread is very intentional. There's no waste. There's no hurry. There's nothing extra. It's incredibly efficient. It's very elegant in its design. That's on purpose. That's your life. We normally don't want to sew certain things back into our lives. We really normally don't. And we normally regard large parts of our lives as wasted. Whether you use those words or not, you know, geez, I wasted the whole morning on that da-da-da, and the guy never called. Really? How would one waste time? How would that be possible? We say it all the time, but how would you waste that? That's interesting. So when we look at our pieces of fabric, when we cut this big piece into all these little pieces, and Tomoe-san, Tomoe Katagiri, is now retired, but when she was teaching this, and now Rosemary goes on to say the same thing, the robe is already there. The robe is already there. We are expected to treat and to use those pieces of cloth and treat those pieces of cloth as if they were the mind and body of Buddha, because, as they would say, they are the mind and body of Buddha. This isn't a symbol of something else. It is that thing. So you start treating it as the robe before it's even sewn together. That makes a lot of sense to me in terms of practice, because does your mind like become yours and whole and okay when all that stuff is taken care of, or is it already there? Do you know what I mean? It isn't, again, Zen is so good at this, it is never a means to an end. It's not like incomplete, 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 complete. That's what, yeah, sort of, but that's way too linear for Zen. That suggests later, and there's never really later, right? So the way we'd even treat these little tiny pieces of cloth is the way we treat the robe. It is the robe. And the way I've had this explained to me, I'm sure there's lots of different ways of talking about this, but you'll see there are long pieces, bigger pieces, called cho, and small pieces called tan. And they say cho, these big pieces, represent your awakening, your enlightenment. And the small parts, the tan, represent delusion. Isn't that interesting? We sew all those together. You'd think, oh, well, I'm going to leave out the delusion parts because this is Buddhism, right? I just want the good stuff. I just want the enlightenment part. But the robe would have holes in it if you left those out. It is whole. So if you actually think about this, that sort of changes the way we relate to it, not only our lives, but meditation practice, right? Is your mind like incomplete when you come here and you're trying to complete it? Do you know what I mean? Does your practice, does your life, does your Buddha include delusion? Of course. How could it not? It'd be absurd to think it didn't. Dogen, our kind of main man in Soto Zen, encourages us to find our enlightenment in delusion. That's real enlightenment, when you find it in delusion. It's not that something needs to be amputated or severed from who you are. So, the author of The Little Prince, this is the quote that's on the front of your programs, the author of The Little Prince said, a rock pile ceases to be a rock pile the moment a single man contemplates it, bearing within him the image of a cathedral. So again, this rakusu doesn't become a rakusu when it's finished. And our robes don't become robes when they're finished. They become rakusus and robes at the very beginning. And the first stitch is a stitch in the robe of the Buddha, and the last stitch is a stitch in the robe of a Buddha. And this, again, is our meditation practice, right? Your meditation practice doesn't become. It just is. And when they teach us that the robe is the mind and body of Buddha, in that sense, it's not different than any other thing. It's not different than any other thing. When we have something that's special, like this garment is special, we run the risk of starting to think that it's special. Right? I mean, I'm contradicting myself, but you get the drift, right? We have special things, special rooms, the zendo, special spaces, oh, the altar, special garments, the robe, to remind us everything is that, right? So we treat it in a certain way. We do certain rituals and stuff around it to remind us this is everything. So when Tomoe-san says, this is the mind and body of the Buddha, that doesn't mean it's limited to this black piece of fabric that's hanging around my neck. She's saying, this is the mind and body of the Buddha. It's also the shirt you're wearing underneath that, and the Bucky Badger t-shirt underneath that, and the bike I rode here on, and my left fingernail, and, right, we're always pushing ourselves past our ideas and our conceptions, our limitations, right? They're self-imposed, and they're helpful, they're useful, it's shorthand, I get it, but we do these practices with such intention that they're structured in such a way that they're forcing us to notice when we wander from that. They're forcing us to remember the boundlessness of what is. The field of awakening includes everything. Includes everything. So the scraps that we sew together don't become the robe, they are the robe. And the robe is just your life, whether you've sewn one or not. It's the clothing you're wearing today. And these moments don't become your life at some magic point when they're seen in sum total. They are your life. And I notice all the time in my own consciousness how I keep thinking life is about to happen, or that life is limited to certain experiences, and that my life excludes other experiences. And it's subtle, the working of our consciousness, but I do that a lot. Driving to Zen Center isn't my life. Arriving at Zen Center is my life. Right? Driving to is just transition. It's not as valuable as other time. It's, I want to get there. Then life. Right? That's why I go faster than I should on the freeway. Isn't that interesting? I've decided that, like, the driving part is, you know, a little ton, and I want to get to the Cho. I want to get to the nice big part where life actually happens. Wow, think of what I'm excluding there. Think of what I leave out when I forget. Well, gee, right now the shape of your life is traffic. I can't touch any other thing in the whole universe other than traffic right now. That's the only thing that's happening. And yet, you know, I find myself creating the story of and wanting and, you know. And then there's that sense of unrest that we're also familiar with that happens in our chest when we're just slightly, or not slightly, massively dissatisfied, you know, with the landscape of our life at that moment. So our life includes our delusion. Our life includes our feelings of separateness. Our life includes our feelings of wholeness. And our lives are not compilations of lots of separate moments, which is, I know, how we normally think of it. When you look at your life as a series of small moments, you can divide those up infinitely, you know, into smaller and smaller and smaller, and just be thinking of your life as an endless series of infinitely small moments. And Zen teaches us that your life is moment. It isn't a compilation or a sum total. It only is moment, and that includes everything. So it's like the sewing needle. For those of you who have sewn by hand, you know as you're pulling that needle through, you're pulling all that thread with you. So all the stitches that are attached to that thread are feeling a little bit of that tension. You're pulling all those moments with you. And in a sense, our moment right now, this moment you find yourself in, the shape of your life right now, is pulling with it all the past moments and all the future moments. Right? This moment right now is just the needle pulling. And you're connected to every single thing you've ever done and every single thing you ever will do. Right? We can see this as conditioned consciousness. Sometimes I think, the way I sort of smile in that crooked, weird way, I got that from Grandma. I'm pulling her with me, even if I don't choose to. Oh, and you know, I'm always really na-na-na about that. Yeah, I got that from Dad. I'm pulling him with me. And someday, a year from now, I'll be doing such and such a thing. And I'm planting the seeds for that right now. Maybe I'm aware of that. Maybe I'm not. But I'm pulling that with me right now too, right? So it's like moment is this needle that just moves through, and it's pulling all these things together. And it includes, you know, past and future, but it includes things that are done, things that I leave undone, all the things I call success, all the things I call failure, the feelings that break my heart, the feelings that fill me with hope. It pulls all those things together. It doesn't care. There's no effort, right? I mean, pulling a needle through a piece of cloth is pretty easy. You're not aware that maybe it's connected to 500 other little tiny stitches. You just pull through this one, right? No problem. One thread. Right, and after a while, you sort of stop making those good, bad, success, failure distinctions, past, future even, because there is just this stitch, this moment. And what's helpful about that for us when we start to get better at choosing when to let go of our ideas about life being defined by success and failure and past and future is that our ideas around progress and our ideas around change, even the illusion of moving forward, kind of falls away a little bit, or at least it gets softer on the edges. And then moment opens up and your life becomes a little more spacious. That sense that we oftentimes have of, I'm almost going to arrive. I'll be arriving any time now. When I get the degree, when I get married, when I have kids, when I lose 20 pounds, when, I don't know, whatever that is for you. You know, that sense of, I'm almost going to arrive, I hope I arrive soon, kind of falls away. Because like, oh, I get it. The entirety of my life includes the fact I still want to lose 20 pounds and I'm not married and don't have kids. That's actually whole. It includes that. So our friend Darla Rehorst, our friend Darla Rehorst says said to me once, I have existed for almost as long as I have been alive. Which I thought was fabulous. She said it in a very different context. It was related to sheep, not sewing. But what I liked about what she said was I thought how often I regard life as including or not including. Like my life, my being alive, sometimes involves me existing and sometimes involves you not existing. And what she reminded me of with that kind of funny sentence was that my life includes my unaware moments. You know that meal you ate that you didn't taste any of? Yeah, your life includes that. Because you were watching TV or you were talking to your friend or you were doing stuff on the computer. Yeah, you didn't taste any of it. That's true. You might learn from that. Oh, you know what might be cool is for me to be more present to my food. Maybe I don't have to watch TV one night. Oh, maybe I can just be. But it's not like you wasted it. It's still part of your life. It happened. Right? Your unaware moments are included. That's why this symbol of the robe including the delusion is so powerful. It prevents us from dividing things up, right? It has to be whole. Our lives are whole, right? So all those things we label as mistakes, all the things we label as missteps, the relationships we label as failures, the dinners we ate that we didn't taste, did our life include those? Yep, it does. It's whole. Yeah. It certainly includes our greedy moments and our sleeping moments and our angry moments. And if your enlightenment, if your awareness doesn't include your delusion, it's not real enlightenment. And we have a history, as you know, lots of spiritual traditions have this, but we have a history of enlightened beings, so-called enlightened beings, who were not aware of their delusion or did not include their delusion, and they caused huge suffering. I'm sure we can all think of examples. Enlightenment in Zen practice is much more about being aware of when you're tricking yourself, being aware of when you're caught. Do I notice that I'm being greedy? If I notice that, it's different now, isn't it? I'm not caught by greed. I'm aware that it has arisen in my consciousness. This is standard Buddhism stuff. Be aware when it arises. That's your enlightenment. You see it. Now you have a choice. Now you can do something, right? If you don't know it's there, now you're acting out of delusion. You don't even know it. So please bring the light to it. It isn't that you've got to cut it off. It's see it. The nature of awareness itself is to start softening. So much of the practice is just see it. Just see it. What do they say? Sunlight is the best... What's that word for something that kills germs?
Disinfectant.
Disinfectant. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. And I went, oh, that's Zazen. I always think everything is about Zazen. But, oh, that's Zazen. Just see it. You know? Just see it. Oh, there's me wanting it to be different. Oh, there's me thinking that guy's a jerk. The thought just arose in my mind, that guy's a jerk. That's all that happened. It doesn't make him a jerk. It doesn't make me even an angry person. It just arose in consciousness. I can see it. If I can hold my awareness on that, it transforms the nature of that experience, right? If I don't know that I just had that thought, I might believe that's true. That guy is a jerk. Because I wasn't aware that that thought arose. I wasn't aware that I didn't choose that thought. I'm not aware that that thought isn't me. It just arose, right? But unless I'm aware of that, it becomes true. Hey, that guy's a jerk. Now I can start thinking about him as a jerk. I have feelings in my chest that make him a jerk. I'm going to treat him like he's a jerk, right? Here I am, filtering my experience, going down a rabbit hole. My life is getting narrower and narrower and narrower, and I don't see it because I didn't recognize. I made a choice, right? I made a choice to see it, and then my life gets a little bigger. So enlightenment is not about having no delusion. It's about being very, very aware of the delusion we do have. And then it stops being your enemy, you guys. It just doesn't... When it arises, you're like, oh yeah, there's that guy's a jerk thought again. Boy, I have that a lot around him. You know, whatever. It's life. Okay, there it is again. Yep, there it is again. So our stitches, as we do this sewing practice... are our breaths. We oftentimes will synchronize the stitches with the breathing and the chant, the refuge chant in the head. Namo Kiye Butsu, Namo Kiye Butsu. I take refuge. And this reminds me as I'm doing this practice that my breath is the same as my vow. I can store my vow in my breath. And our vow in Zen takes lots of different forms, but essentially it's the vow to awaken. It's the vow to have whatever this thing is I call my life be of service, to have it be an offering, to aspire to live in a way that is conducive to the alleviation of suffering, to free all beings. So I can store that in my stitches, I can store that in my breath. It helps me get in touch with that center of what my practice is about. And then it becomes less about what am I getting, it becomes less about creating a garment made out of cloth, it becomes more of storing that aspiration, that awakeness that I aspire to in a very deep place in me. And of course that, you know, the thread in a literal sense ties all these pieces together. And if we equate the thread with our vow, with our breath, with our practice, that's what ties all the pieces together of your life, right? Your awareness is what ties your delusion to your enlightenment. You just saw it. Now it's included, right? We say in our robe chant in the morning, how great the robe of liberation, a field far beyond form and emptiness, wrapping ourselves in Buddha's teaching, freeing all beings. The field far beyond form and emptiness is what you are. It's what you're wearing, whether you're wearing one of these or not. And our practice, our vow, our breath is what ties all these pieces together. The thing you liked, the thing you didn't like. your memories of the past, your dreams for the future, the pain in your leg, the sound of the plane going overhead, the times you went to sleep, the times you woke up. That's what ties all that together into one whole. Right? One whole. It's not about picking and choosing what stays in and what goes. It's about tying it all together with our aspiration, with our vow. So the second little piece I put on the program this morning is my roomie. And he writes, "Being in a hurry throws the key on the ground to a door I want you to enter. If you read my words slowly and out loud, they will help you pick the lock." Being in a hurry prevents us from entering the door. And we notice one of the things that's nice about sewing practice is that it is, to some degree, linear, and it is goal-oriented. Because at the end, you're supposed to have Raksu. In fact, in the end, and that's 3 months from now, you better get going. You got a lot of, you know, right? A lot of cloth to do, a lot of stitches to do. Hurry up. And you notice how subtly, even though the stitches are a set size, they start getting farther and farther apart. I'm not alone in this, right? You guys, some of you have sewn, you know this, right? They start getting a little farther apart. Tomoe-san used to say, "Ah, greedy needle." And I went, "Oh, man, so much of my life is a greedy needle." That's exactly the traffic jam for me. I always use traffic jam because it's like never stops triggering me every single time. I don't want to be in traffic. I want to be at home, at Zen Center, at wherever it is I'm going, right? My stitches get really greedy, and it's in the form of a right foot on a right pedal going another 5 miles an hour, right? Because I value what I imagine the future moment to be more than I value the current moment, right? So my stitches get very greedy. If they get too greedy, whoosh, out they come, the stitches, just so you know. I'm warning you. I know some of you are thinking about this. So. Whoosh, out they come. But again, all this is about is seeing your mind. Oh, I see that I'm restless. I see that I want to. I see that I... Right? And we say, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. A lot of you have heard that before. The way you do anything is the way you do everything. When I first heard that, I started realizing, oh, that's kind of a merciless mirror. At least it was for me, because, you know, I treat the Raksu very differently than I treat my socks. Now I don't have an excuse for treating my socks carelessly. The way you do anything is the way you do everything. So if I throw my keys down carelessly, that's the whole shape of my mind right now, isn't it? It's restless. It's scattered. I don't value this. This moment is not valuable to me. This object's not valuable to me. I'm already on to the next thing. Wow, that's the whole shape of my mind right now. You're totally seeing my mind when you see me. Kick off my shoes carelessly, throw down my keys carelessly. And that moment passes, and then I'm on to something else. But, right? Isn't that a pretty honest reflection? I'm like, wow. Wow. So much of what we do around Zen Center, whether it's the way we eat formally, the way we sew formally, the way we do zazen with the posture, the way we do the chanting, the way we do the gassho, all these little specific details about the forms, how we're supposed to get them right, is less about everybody just being OCD around here. Because that's actually not the case. It's more about you see that this shows your mind. This is your mind. And so when you do a half-hearted gassho, that's where you're exactly where you're at. I can see your mind right now because I'm not valuing this. I'm already busy with the next thing. So I like the specificity of forms because it shows me so clearly where my stitches get greedy, when I get impatient, when I'm on to the next thing, right? So I appreciate that about. And I started to notice, like I'm sure a lot of you know, like our meal chant here says, we regard greed as the obstacle to freedom of mind. We regard greed as the obstacle to freedom of mind. Yeah, I started looking at my mind going, I think that's really true. When I want something to be different, I'm not free right now, am I? I'm actually kind of constricted. Right? And so I started thinking, when my stitches get greedy, when I'm going 5 miles over the speed limit and I shouldn't be because I'm in a rush, I think what feeds that feeling is some sort of core idea I have that I'm lacking something, or that this moment, this experience is lacking something. I want it to be better. And so I'm in a hurry to get through this. I am greedy. Right? And I started thinking, well, obviously when we don't feel we lack anything, we don't want anything. Every time you've ever wanted anything in your life is because you felt you lacked it. Which makes sense, right? Your stomach gets hungry when it doesn't have food. That's the point of hunger, to say, by the way, we're lacking food down here. We could use some. Right? Pretty honest, pretty cool. When I feel I am lacking the iPhone 6, what's that about? It's true I don't have the iPhone 6. What's that actually about? Will that feeling be sated if I get it? And if it does, how long will it last? Right? It's that sort of Christmas morning thing of like, woohoo, I'm super content for about 20 minutes. Because what does the Buddha teach? Desire is infinite. Desire is infinite. Desire is infinite. If I actually knew that in every cell of my body, it would change entirely the way that I want things. Absolutely change everything. If you just know, it's just going to rise again. But I'm convinced most of us most of the time think, this will be the thing. This will solve it once and for all. I'm like 85% certain iPhone 6 would solve it once and for all. Wow, how quick we are to do that. How quick we are to want something else. So we walk through the world as hungry ghosts so much of the time. So the invitation with this practice, the invitation with sewing, when you watch your stitches getting greedy or your driving getting too fast, is to become very intimate with that feeling of lack. Don't try to get bigger stitches or go faster to avoid it. That's why we do that, right? We don't like that feeling. We want to try to take care of it by going faster, getting more. So the invitation is, no, actually do the opposite. Slow down. Turn toward it. What is that feeling? Is there a way you can be intimate with this? Again, it's that same thing of just using awareness itself as the light. That's the disinfectant. Look at it. Can you feel that feeling? What is that impatience about? What is that lack about? Let me just be intimate with that. It's not as dangerous as I'm scared it is. I'm all scared it's dangerous. It's going to eat me or destroy me. It's not. I can be with that feeling. What is it? How can I be really at home wherever I am? Really at home. There's a wonderful Taoist story about this, so I'll read for you. A formal delegation from a Confucian temple sought the advice of a Taoist hermit living alone in the mountains. When they arrived at his hut unannounced, they were scandalized to find him completely naked. "What are you doing meditating in your hut with no pants on?" they demanded. "The whole world is my hut," he replied, "and this small room is my pants. What I want to know is, what are you doing in my pants?" Wow.
Can you read that again?
Sure. Sure, yeah. A formal delegation from a Confucian temple sought the advice of a Taoist hermit living alone in the mountains. When they arrived at his hut unannounced, they were scandalized to find him completely naked. "What are you doing meditating in your hut with no pants on?" they demanded. "The whole world is my hut," he replied, "and this small room is my pants. What I want to know is, what are you doing in my pants?" So that is a funny story, obviously. And I also love it because this whole world is my hut. He's at home. I'm at home. Wherever I am. We aspire to that. When I'm in traffic and I feel something burning in me because this isn't good enough, I'm not at home now, am I? And of course I've had that feeling thousands of times at home, right? Or my literal physical dwelling. It has nothing to do, actually, with the people who are with me or the place that I am. It has entirely to do with the condition of my heart. Exclusively. Exclusively with the condition of my heart. Right? So contentment is just wanting nothing to be different. That's when we feel at home, when we don't want anything to be different. All of a sudden the world is huge. And everything is still, because we just don't want anything to be different. Right? And that includes our difficulty. I'm sure every single person in this room has experienced at least a flash of contentment that included suffering. My back hurts, and I'm content. My loved one is sick, and I'm content. I haven't graduated yet, and I still haven't found a wife, and I'm content. Right? It has nothing to do with when the good thing happens. Contentment couldn't care less about good or bad. Who cares? Seriously. Good or bad, that's just your idea. Those things are coming and going anyway. You can't hang on to those things. You can't. Do you want something to be different? Now. we have friction. Now we have upset. Now we have turbulence when we want something to be different. And everybody knows that. Everybody. And the harder you want it, the more. You can almost feel it in your body, can't you? Oh, it's pain. So, the way I'm using the metaphor of sewing today is that the needle can represent my individual life, my sense of me, my ego self. And it can pull with it the thread that is the spiritual context of sewing. It is my teacher and my teacher's teacher and my teacher's teacher's teacher. Right? It's Katagiri and Dogen and Bodhidharma and the Buddha. I pull the needle of my life, and it includes my Sangha, it includes my friends, my families, my memories, my past, my future. For me, it pulls the tradition of Zen Buddhism. It pulls my grandparents. It includes Roman Catholicism. That's how I was raised. All those ancestors and children being pulled forward. And that act of doing that practice, which is exactly your life, right? It's the breath you're taking now, is verifying all of those things. It is verification of what you'll be doing in a year from now. It's verification of what you did a year ago. It's verification of your parents. It's verification of everybody you've ever hated. It's verification of everybody you've ever loved, right? Your life, this little tiny needle, is pulling all that with it, right? All that. But as much as I like that metaphor, and I think it's lovely, so I'll kind of play with that if it's of value to you. But as much as I like it, Zen loves to sort of give us little toys, sort of metaphors and little games, and then it likes to take them away from us. It usually, right when we start to like them, is when it takes it away. So before I wrap up, I just want to kind of explode the whole metaphor. Because you can, and I'm guessing you already know why, because at some point I can become very attached to my needle and my thread. Can't I? I start to forget that it's your needle and your thread too. I start to forget interconnectedness. I start to forget impermanence. So I think Zen gives us koans and metaphors and symbols and rituals and forms. They do give us toys because we need them. It's part of how our brain works, symbolic consciousness. It's part of how we operate in the world. But it's very good at taking away at some point to remind us these are just representations of. So it's kind of like a kid, you know. The kid is happy because they're playing in the play box with their favorite toy, but if you take the toy away, they're still going to play in the play box. They don't care. A kid can play for hours with no toys. They're just fine without toys. And we're the same way in practice. I don't need this garment to do zazen, do I? I really don't. Can I have a sense of the deep meaning and connection of my practice without one of these? You bet. A lot of people have. Thousands of people have. Millions probably have. So these symbols, these forms, serve a hugely important function. At least for me, they ignite my imagination. They give energy to my practice. They open me up to other ways of being. But once they've done those things, we can let them go. Or we can at least let go of our attachment to them. I may wear this at Zen Center every day I'm here for the rest of my life. But that's different than being dependent upon that toy, right? So I'm encouraging you to forget the thread idea. I'm encouraging you to forget the idea that you would need thread to sew. You don't need thread to sew. You can sew perfectly well without thread. You can sew perfectly well without a needle. You're doing it all the time. You don't need a technique. You don't need ideas about Buddhism. You don't need this sense of connection to the past or any of these metaphors about pulling things along with you. You don't need any of that. You really don't. Those are all contextual and they help us. But I think our ideas about our life are the least true thing about them. I'm not saying they're untrue. I just think they're the least true thing about them. Our ideas about our life are important. I think they're really important, but our life exists way beyond our ideas of it. So like all of our teachings here, use these ideas if they help you. Tim says, when I have some sort of idea, well, keep that idea as long as you need it. Keep it warm, but don't believe in it. I always like that. Keep it warm, but don't believe in it. As long as you need it, you can use it, and then you let it go. But if we do attach to our needle and our thread, it can give rise in us what I started about talking about, which is greed, attachment, ideas of progress, ideas of comparing our stitches to other people's stitches, our tradition to other people's tradition. What we cultivate in Zen practice, what we prize most highly, is just wholehearted engagement with the moment. Just give everything you got to just this. And there isn't then any sense of it representing something else. It isn't symbolic of anything else. You're not carrying anything along with you. It's just this. You don't need the needle idea. You don't need the thread idea. Just so. Just practice. Then there's nothing left out. There's nothing extra. There's just this moment as it is. And actually, we have no choice in this. I'm making it sound like we have a choice, but actually, we're always sewing moment to moment without any needle or any thread, because there is just this. There isn't anything other than just this. It's just your life happening. It's just your life happening. It's beyond all of your ideas. So there isn't a separate needle to defend or to protect or to worry about. There's not special thread that you need to uphold or drag along. There's no separate items in your life. There's no separate moments in your life. There's just steady, gentle, silent activity that you call life, and it includes everything. So all we do on our cushion and all we do here is we just relinquish all of our ideas about it, and we relinquish our agenda about it, and then sewing just sews, and life just lives, and practice just practices. And there's no effort. There's no problem. There's no problem. There's no effort. It just happened. Just the way you live right now. No problem. No effort. Very easy. It's open heart, open hands. It's innocent. It's very innocent. So I thank you. I thank you for your attention this morning, and I think that's all I want to say about sewing, but we have a few minutes anyway, maybe a question or two. If anybody has anything to share or ask, or please.
What do you do when you identify delusions and they become judgments?
When identifying the delusion becomes a judgment? Oh, that's a good question. And it's one of our favorites. We all do that a lot. When we see delusion, I think I'm hearing you right, like when you notice yourself being caught by delusion, you then judge yourself for being caught by delusion. Oh, yeah, notice it. Really, just notice it, let it go. Because in Zen, you might say, like, don't put a head on top of your head, or at least don't put a head on top of that head, because you could go like, oh, I'm deluded. Oh, I'm an idiot for being deluded. Oh, I'm an idiot for judging myself for being deluded. Oh, I'm really an idiot for judging myself for judging myself. You know, I mean, you can stack heads basically infinitely, and then you can't walk indoors. So what I always do is wherever it is that you can accept, start there. So like when you notice delusion, I can't accept that I'm deluded. The invitation is just to notice it. Oh, that's what's happening, right? The delusion's gone, actually, when you notice it. Oh, I see that I'm being greedy. Oh, I'm not fighting with it. Because now I have something I'm not accepting. I'm just noticing, oh, I notice I'm really being greedy about that. Can I just relax and open that up? Sure. Okay, and if you can't, then can I accept the fact that I'm not very good at seeing this? I have a lot of judgment around myself. Ooh, no, maybe I can't. Maybe I am judging myself for judging myself for being deluded. But at some point, no matter how many heads up you have to go, start with a place you can go, this is okay. And by okay, I don't mean condone, support, water the seeds. I just mean, I can be intimate with this. You're asking a really good question, because on the cushion, that's how it oftentimes shows up. And actually in our lives, that's how it oftentimes shows up. Like, oh, I'm really lonely. God, why would I be so, you know, and I'm judging myself for being lonely? I'm actually avoiding the primary feeling, which is I'm just lonely. I don't have to have a story around that. I can just feel it. You know, when I see it, when I feel it, it starts to open, doesn't it? It just changes. You know how things do when you're intimate with them? They just start to kind of open. That's the transformational element. And when I can't accept it, oh, I'm really being judging about being lonely. Okay, can I really be soft and accept, oh, I really see that I'm judging that? It's a very gentle, what I'm describing is a very gentle process, but that's zazen. I mean, awareness is very kind. So if you can't accept your delusion, can you accept you're not accepting it? If you can't, can you accept you're not accepting if you're not accepting it? It sounds silly. It sounds like a Dr. Seuss book at some point. But that's really actually it. Because the delusions aren't a problem, and your judgments aren't a problem. The fact you don't want to have them is the problem. So if you can hold that lovingly, oh, then all of a sudden, it's almost like a house of cards, the whole thing kind of falls. Is that in any way helpful? Just a small, yeah. That's a great question, thank you. Anything else real quick before we... Yeah.
It's almost like happiness is a state that I can sit in, yeah, and I'm just, because I'm happy. You know, I'm not agonizing about something. I'm not fearful. And I'm wondering whether I should be just saying, well, I'm free of fear at this moment because I'm happy. You know, I mean, that sort of like makes it much more complicated. But is this the moment, is a moment of happiness there where you are not necessarily conscious of it? How would you describe
that? That's a really interesting question, isn't it, to start playing with? Like, because a little bit of that is like, well, is happy just the absence of pain, or is it something else? Because we do tend to be caught, I mean, our attention seems to be caught by moments of ecstatic joy that you're for sure not missing because you are over the moon, or the moments that are wretched, or some shade of wretched. That's interesting. Can you have an emotional state and be operating from that place and not aware that you're operating from that place? I suppose, yeah.
I mean, when you get lost.
Yeah.
And you might even call it OCD, you know, mm-hmm. It's like when you are lost, say, in a painting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're not
thinking,
just completely in the
moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like flow, sort of. Yeah. You know, people talk about that a lot. With flow. Yeah, for me, and I don't know if this is your answer, but for me, aware, you know, the cultivation of awareness is always central. So, the early sutras always talk about just when you're in a given emotional state, being aware you're in a given emotional state, labeling it as such, and just recognizing it. And it is my long-held suspicion that everybody is content way more than they know that they are. We're like way happier than we think we are, but because we're so caught by the miserable that you're like, wow, everything's actually going like really well right now, and you just aren't aware of it. So if you were more aware, you'd be like, hey, actually, geez, most of this whole life thing is pretty groovy. I can handle this. So I'm, yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, I agree.
Thank you.
Susan.
I find that words like love and happiness are so non-specific.
Yeah.
But it's kind of confusing because is contentment the same as happiness?
Mm-hmm.
If you were really lost in a good feeling, probably the Buddha would call that delusion too. Mm-hmm. Because you're lost, mm-hmm. You know, you're in a... So it's, mm-hmm. It seems more complicated than that. Even that Pharrell Williams song, Happy, Happy, you know, it's a great song. I really like it. It makes me feel joy. Whenever. But then that seems more specific.